Have you ever thought about that while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb? I did. I actually bought two homes in Albuquerque that I Airbnb'd, and it was just an amazing investment, honestly, because, you know, as you are accruing value in your property, you are also making money on the Airbnbs. It's amazing. So your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
21 Seeds infused tequila is a must-have. It's an award-winning tequila. It's infused with real juice, with real fruit, which means the flavors are built in. It's real. So you need like two or three ingredients to make your perfect cocktail. Hey, you know how I'm always trying to keep my house parties exciting? New cocktails? Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, well, here's something that's going to flip the script.
Okay.
All right, 21 Seeds infused tequila.
Yeah. Tell me more about this, right? Oliver Hudson.
Yeah, 21 Seeds is an award-winning tequila that's infused with juice from real fruits. You only need two to three ingredients to make the perfect cocktail.
Wait a minute. I think I know what brand you're talking about. You know why?
Yeah.
Because 21 Seeds is founded by two sisters and their friend. It's female founded.
That's right.
See?
Sounds
See
like
how I know? Something I can get behind.
I know. Well, there's a good story behind that for sure. Listen, if you love tequila, you have to try 21 Seeds infused tequila. Enjoy responsibly. 21 Seeds, Diageo, New York, New York.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
Hi, I'm Kate Hudson.
And my name is Oliver Hudson.
We wanted to do something that highlighted our relationship.
And what it's like to be siblings.
We are a sibling revelry.
No, no.
Sibling revelry.
Don't do that with your mouth.
Sibling revelry.
That's good.
This was such a great conversation. We spoke with Lisa and Brian Henson, and that this is... Jim Henson, who is the creator of the Muppets. These are his children.
That was
yeah.
Papa.
And these are his children who have taken it over since he passed and have been doing some really interesting things and keeping his work and then adding to it as well going. I loved it. I loved every second of it.
Me too. Well, even just a little window into his parents too, you know, and their how they came from, you know, how they met in like puppeteering school, and it was so like it's just so eccentric and offbeat and odd, you know what I mean? That
yeah,
whole world.
I mean, and also the artistry behind it. I mean, it really is. It kind of feels like it's a dying art, and yet there's still all these amazing, you know, puppeteers out there who are creating these incredible puppets, and also learning about the Muppets. I had no idea half of the things that I learned on this about SNL, about that it was not intended for children. I mean, it was like the whole thing. I was just very taken by.
Mm-hmm. Also, just like the icons, like how Kermit and Miss Piggy sort of came about.
Oh, Kermit, we sang for them. Didn't we sing for them?
We did.
Or did we sing for ourselves?
Well, you sang. I think we might have sang after.
We got off and
yeah,
then we
probably
and then I had a little Kermit with me and we sang Rainbow Connection. Mm-hmm. I think we destroyed Rainbow Connection. I think that's really what happened.
I love that song.
I know.
Oh my
it reminds
God.
Me of you.
It's the Willie Nelson version, especially. But it was also just a really interesting conversation because these kids have had to take over an iconic
brand,
company. And brand, exactly. And you know, how to manage that and how to sort of individuate but still keep the integrity of what their dad wanted them to do. It was just a really fun
conversation. They were engaged and willing to tell the stories, and it was really, really fun. And they're doing really cool shit right now too.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And Lisa Henson, who really runs the show, she was just so sharp. I just enjoyed her frankness, and you could tell that she is more of the sort of structured type of brain, whereas her brother, Brian, is more of the creative, you know, and kind of like more director style. And
yeah, she's the designated driver when Brian's like on 18 hits of acid.
Well, I'm not so sure Brian is an 18 hits of acid kind of guy, Ollie, but yeah.
I don't know. Well, it was a good conversation. You're going to enjoy it. And check out Earth to Ned, because I'm on it. And I actually worked with Brian Henson.
Hey, Ollie, do you remember when, because I forgot that they, it's also Fraggle Rock.
Oh, God. Yeah. Come to Fraggle Rock. Ka-ka. Take them from another day. Tappa-tappa-doo.
I mean, these are down things that are like ingrained.
Yeah.
They're ingrained in my head.
Fraggle Rock. Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is flashbulb memory stuff.
Big time.
You know, where I'm like,
you're like going down into the rock, into the mountain.
Sensory things.
Yeah. The title sequence, it's like, it's just like ingrained in my old brain.
Yep. I know. It's true. It's triggered. It's a bit triggering. You're like, oh, no. Like, where's our father?
where. what was your favorite Muppet?
That's a hard one. Gosh, I mean, Animal was always stood out. You know, just he was just crazy. I like that. You know.
Yeah.
But then Oscar, you know, Oscar the Grouch, always dug him.
And I know Oscar the Grouch. Mm-hmm.
Aww. Beaker always made me laugh. He's just a weirdo.
I loved Animal.
Animal was great.
And Miss Piggy. I mean, Miss Piggy. I just always thought she was so funny. I mean,
she was badass.
All right. Well, I hope you guys enjoy this episode. It's really interesting, and we absolutely loved having them on the show.
Yeah, we started off by talking about Earth to Ned, which I did, which is now on Disney Plus.
So, without further ado, here is Lisa and Brian Henson.
This is something we've been working on for quite a while. But so Ned is a big, giant alien, and he's the captain of a spaceship. And they were sent to Earth basically to invade or destroy Earth. But Ned instead fell in love with Earth, mostly through TV. He started monitoring TV, and he just fell in love with everything. Entertainment and celebrities and pop culture. And so he and his Lieutenant Cornelius, who's his put upon sidekick, and their artificial intelligence Betty, who is a virtual character. And then there's a whole bunch of these little clods that are running around, which are kind of the crew, the disposable crew. And so he decided, rather than invading and destroying Earth, I'm going to do a talk show so that I'll be the most beloved celebrity in the world. That's basically what he wants. Mm-hmm. So, and then what he does is he and Cornelius have the ability to just beam anybody into their ship anytime they want. And Oliver was beamed into
I was beamed in, and
it was a ball.
And the actor was off stage, you know, improvising with me. It was all improv, which was so fun.
Well, he's a puppeteer. He was working the face.
Oh, he was working the face. Yeah,
on Ned, there's two puppeteers working the face by remote, and then there's one puppeteer inside and three puppeteers under, all six of them working one character.
Okay, so now that we're talking about puppeteering,
it was a blast.
I want to start from the beginning. Now, but for those who don't know that are listening right now, your father was the beloved and very infamous and
infamous.
I mean, famous.
Infamous. Notorious.
It's like the Three Amigos. He's like, no. He's infamous. He's more than famous.
Three Amigos. We love that movie. Jim Henson. And I know for us, he is like a staple, not only in our childhood and your guys' childhood, clearly, but even kids today, their childhood. He just lives on and on. And
one of the things I learned when I was doing my research on you guys was that your mom and him met literally, your parents met at puppeteer school.
They met in a puppeteering class. That's right.
Yeah.
I didn't know how influential your mother was to all of this as well. So I kind of want to just start with where were you born?
Well, I'm going to start with where I was born because I'm the oldest. So okay. I was born in Washington, D.C., and that's where our parents were living at that time. As you said, they met in puppeteering class at the University of Maryland. My father was a freshman, and he was really precocious and advanced. And you know, my mom always said that it was like he was teaching the class. Like he had already been doing a puppet show on television locally, which he'd started as a teenager. So he was just taking that class just to get a really easy credit because he was already a puppeteer. And so he sort of took the lead in the class and thought she was a pretty good student. And so he hired her to come and help him on the local television show. And she was 3 years older than him. So it was a freshman and a senior, which seemed like a vast age gulf when they first met. But then they worked together for a long, long time, best of friends, partners in the business, and then ultimately very romantically involved.
Mm. Were they both from D.C. or where were they from originally?
My father was born in Mississippi.
Yeah. Mom born in New York City.
So what year was this?
In the 50s, like late
50s.
And I was born
middle 50s, yeah.
I was born in 1960, and somebody had sort of the bad idea, at least it's sort of been a kind of a bad joke on me, of incorporating the Muppets on my birthday, which has caused people to celebrate Kermit the Frog's birthday on my birthday. So it will show up as like a, you know, when you say like what celebrities are born on what day, it will be like May 9th, 1960, Kermit the Frog. It's like, not Kermit. That's me. I was born that day.
How many kids are there? How many siblings do you have? Five.
There are five total. Our brother died.
Right. It's a podcast. Like when you hold up five fingers, that just means nothing.
You're right. That doesn't help at all. There were five of us. Our brother passed away. Mm. And so there's now three girls and one boy.
And what's the age difference from Lisa, from you to the youngest?
10 years. My mom had five kids in 10 years.
Wow.
It was just a brood.
But she had four of us in 5 years. And then the fifth was 5 years later. So she was literally just pregnant.
So what was that? What was the house like? What was it like growing up? Just craziness?
You almost asked the most unwelcome question that we're always asked, which is like, did dad do puppets around the house?
Oh, no.
And did we think the puppets were real? So
I wasn't going there quite yet.
No, but Oliver, you're allowed to, because when Oliver came on Earth to Ned, we asked your permission, but we did the whole interview where Ned is only excited about everybody else in your family. And just wants to know about Kurt.
We have that in common. I was gonna say, like, the relatable aspect of this interview will be, we know what it's like when people ask the same. So what kind of advice did your dad give you? When
was it just performing every morning at breakfast?
Yeah, like, that's right. Were you singing? Did you sing a lot?
Right, yeah.
Around the
table. Didn't happen.
No, well, for us, we had a house full of animals. And our mother was, she co-founded the Muppets and was very, but obviously once it was a house full of kids, she was also like an art teacher. She would sometimes be a substitute, but she was like an art teacher at home. So there was always crazy arts and crafts that were half finished in rooms all over the place. And then there was just animals mm-hmm. everywhere.
What kind of animals? Like dogs and cats, or like rabbits and birds?
It was, well, I had rabbits. My brother had ferrets. We had guinea pigs. We had hamsters at one point with birds. Mostly a lot of cats. And the cats, we couldn't even keep the cats away. Like, the cats would run away from a neighbor's house and come move into our house. And then we couldn't get the cat to move back to the neighbors. So we just ended up like gathering cats like a snowball.
Yeah, some of them had, some of them didn't have good names either, because after we had so many cats, then they would just get named for like where they came from. Like one was named Wilderness, one was named Woods.
Woody.
And one and then we just gave up. One was named Kitty.
Although my cat that I had, we were allowed to name our, the first cats we got, we each named, and mine was named Snowy Feet.
Wow.
Because
Snowy
he had white
feets.
Feet. But it was specifically Snowy Feet, which was weird.
Like,
oh, but the
Snowy
other thing
feets.
About our cat house is the cats, the way they would get into the house is we would leave this door open on the second floor terrace off the back of the house. And the cats would climb the outside of the house, which was wood. Literally, they'd hang on with their claws and climb up one story to get to the terrace. And that's the way they would get in and out of the house, particularly during the night. And the raccoons figured it out. And the raccoons started following the cats up. And then the raccoons and the cats got along, so it was all fine. And so we, raccoons started eating with the cats. And my mother was like, ah, what the heck, I'll just feed them all. So then we got to the point where we'd be sitting having dinner and there'd be three raccoons at the right at the patio door next to us, just waiting for their dinner. It was crazy. The house was like a crazy zoo.
It was.
It really was.
Were there any rules? I mean, was it very free home to do what you please?
Yeah, it was pretty unruly.
Yeah.
It was pretty free. Like there were even like things you would think they have to have a rule against, that like jumping off the balcony into the swimming pool or jumping down the laundry chute two floors. Like everything was allowed as far as I can remember.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
When you were kids, was the Muppets happening?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Was that before you were born?
Yeah. The Muppets were started, what, officially? Did 55, Lisa? 55 to 58. It's like I think it became incorporated in 58, but really they started like in 55, which is, you know, 5 years before Lisa was born. And then like Sesame Street, see, up until Sesame Street, our dad never did any, he didn't do kid stuff.
Yeah.
He did the special with your mom. He was on.
Yep.
That's right.
Yeah. And,
oh my God,
I forgot about
that.
That's
right.
Yeah. And Kermit was a guest. And
yes.
They did a very funny piece where Goldie kisses Kermit and Kermit warns her that he might turn into a prince, and then she kisses him and she turns into a puppet, and then Ruth Buzzy comes in and everybody turns into puppets because they're kissing each other. It's pretty ridiculous, but hilarious. But up until Sesame Street, our dad didn't do kids pride. He did some very early in his career, but then when Sesame Street came out, he started like entertaining to our age group. So, so we were like, I was like the perfect age for Sesame Street. Lisa, who's 3 years older than me, was probably just a little old for Sesame Street, right, Lisa, when they started making?
Sesame Street came out when I was 10. So I would say I was really a lot too old for Sesame, since I learned my alphabet away a lot longer.
Right. But also originally Sesame Street was targeting like the 5-year-old market. It's gone younger and younger and younger as it's gotten older.
So how did it all start though? I mean, Sesame Street was for kids. It was more sort of adult material prior to Sesame Street.
Yeah, before that he was on Ed Sullivan. He was a regular on the Muppets as an act, Ed Sullivan, did the Tonight Show, did your mom special, Sonny and Cher. They would basically do appearances, and then the Muppets had some specials too. They did them. In fact, we were just looking at my dad's diaries. And after doing the Goldie Hawn show, he came up with the idea of doing a Valentine special. And he wanted to do it with Goldie. But then I guess she wasn't available. And he ended up, once he finally did sell it, he ended up doing it with Mia Farrow. But it's interesting that it was.
Oh, and, that's so cute. I love that. Isn't it crazy when you think about like what that time must have been like for them? Because you had just that one opportunity. How many channels did you have, you know, to be able to do
channels,
special like
that? Yeah, and those variety shows were so interesting. I remember going to watch a lot of the tapings and, you know, just even the idea of a variety show, is a little bit alien today. Like, because I tell people, they were like, how did the Muppets get started? I said, well, they were on variety shows. They were a variety act. And they went from one variety show to another. And ultimately, the Muppet Show kind of grew out of that because it was the Muppets' chance to have their own variety show and bring on guests versus them being the guests on somebody else's variety show. Mm-hmm. But the whole genre, it feels like it's, you know, so much of the past.
Yeah. Oliver and I were just talking about this, how we want to do a show, and we were like, maybe we should do a variety show.
I know, they're dead. We should revive the variety
with
show.
The numbers and the, you know, actual like moving cameras
and all that jazz. Do they work a ton? I mean, were you guys on your own to do your stuff, or were they home a lot?
Well, there were so many kids that our mother had to pretty much stop working. So our mother was home with us.
Got it.
Almost all the time. But our dad was working all the time. He would try to come home. Mm-hmm. If he was in New York, he would generally come home. But I can remember he would come home like maybe just before we would go to bed often. Mm-hmm. And he worked a lot. He was also crazy. He could do like 72-hour stretches. And he was just one of those people. Like in the beginning of Sesame Street, he and Frank Oz and Don Saline, which was most of what Muppets Inc. was in those days, in the first year of Sesame Street, they did all the animated films too. Mm. So he was also an animator for Sesame Street and did these animated films. But they used to go in and just work nonstop until they'd finished the film, like work for 55 hours without stopping or sleeping.
Wow.
And he also worked a lot in Canada and in England. And so we did get used to him being gone for long stretches of time. Yeah. And, you know, when you think back, like that was no texting with your kid, family, you know, that was really out of touch.
Where were you guys living at the time? Like, where was the family home?
Suburbs of New York.
Yeah. Armonk. We were in Armonk, New York, which is right next to Bedford, New York, which more people know.
Yeah.
And I was born in New York City, but then right after I was born, the family moved to Greenwich, Connecticut, and then just over the border to Bedford, New York. And that's where we grew up until we all went off to school.
So wait, growing up, what was your relationship like with your siblings? Was it a pretty tight group? There's a lot of you. There's five of you. I mean, was it a big unit, or were there little factions?
At first, when we were really young, like we didn't even have other playmates. Particularly, we lived in this beautiful home in Greenwich, Connecticut.
In Greenwich, yeah, we had.
And there were no neighbors. And my mom is a little bit antisocial. So like we were each other's playmates. That was it. And then later we moved to Armonk, New York. We had a neighborhood. We started to make some other friends. But yeah, when we were little, like, we were extremely close knit. Mm.
Yeah, we were close. But, you know, there weren't factions so much, but certainly we were so close in age that always creates some issues. Like, I wanted my friends, but my brother wanted my friends. And then my sister, you know, like for me, I've got there's a sister between Lisa and I. So then Lisa and I are only 3 years apart. Mm. So, and there's one in the middle. So my older sister was just like 1 to 2 grades higher than me, depending on whether it was before or after I had to be held back. And then my brother was 1 grade under me. And it was just like, we were so close in age.
I was just like crossed my mind something really interesting, and maybe it's not to anybody else but me, but I was thinking about how when we were growing up, when we were young, nobody knew really who our parents were until we got older, until we were more in the teens, because our parents made movies that we didn't watch when we were kids. So, but for you guys, your parents did things that like every kid was watching. I mean, like millions of kids over 100 countries watched the Muppets or Sesame Street. Like everybody that you must have known when you were little knew that like your parents, that your family was the one thing they watched.
They knew the Muppets. Some people knew Jim Henson because he had done personal appearances on talk shows, but really it was the Muppets that were so famous. And then what happened is my dad, I think he did the first American Express card commercial? It was that American Express card.
First campaign. Yeah, the first time they did that signature campaign.
The one where they said, you may not know me, but you do know of me, or what was the catchphrase of that, Lisa? Do you remember? Mm-hmm.
Something like
that. I remember that.
It was all hosted by people who their work was very well known, but people didn't know them. I don't know. But that ad took off like wildfire, and they just placed it everywhere all the time. So for us, literally like overnight, our dad became face famous. Mm.
Right. Like, he was the American
like,
Express
up until
guy.
One day, he could be anywhere and nobody knew who the heck he was. And then it felt like the next day he couldn't walk down the street without being recognized.
It was also the height of popularity of Sesame Street. So he was like a, as we were saying, like sort of a variety show act, not the, you know, the Muppets were not the star of a huge hit show. And so Sesame was also very big at that time. And it was so big, I think they showed it on PBS like 4 times a day. Mm-hmm. Like you could just turn on that channel and it would just be Sesame Street all the time. And so, yeah, the 1-2 punch of the American Express ad and then the Sesame Street success. And I think this was around 71 or so that this happened. Then suddenly he was very famous.
I was just talking about this actually. I forget with who, but I was saying how Sesame Street was so far ahead of its time as far as inclusion and diversity and, you know, finding the oddities and bringing them to light. You know what I mean? It was just so far ahead of its time. It was so, so progressive.
Yeah.
So progressive.
It truly was. And also the equity, the idea that that urban kids were not getting the same advantage of private preschools. And even at that time, it wasn't even preschool. It was really kindergarten. You know, they were, you know, kids that were not going to kindergarten and then other kids that were going to full-time kindergarten, they had a big advantage over the other kids. But just the idea that the show should be created, you know, not only to harness the power of television in terms of educating kids, but really to address a kind of societal inequity, which does feel very contemporary.
Mm-hmm. It does. I mean, obviously that was your dad's vision, right? I mean, from the
get-go. It actually wasn't. Oh, no. He was on it from the very beginning. He was a big talent get for them. It was actually created by academics and public television producers who created, they had a workshop called Children's Television Workshop, and it was with academics at Harvard. They studied what could be taught to kids through television. And it was, you know, really, I think the first like hard educational show on mm-hmm. television. Cause mm-hmm. now we think, well, there are just hundreds of educational shows, but at the time that was it. They experimented on how you could teach and then they did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the big shows when Sesame Street came out were like Mr. Rogers and
Romper Room.
Romper
that was local.
Room
no, that was local.
Captain Kangaroo.
So
for me growing up, like I remember going on the sets of Big Trouble in Little China and I was just in awe, right? Like it made me want to be creative. It was like, oh yeah, this is the world that I want to be a part of. I want to do this. I mean, I wonder, there's 5 kids of all of the kids. Did all of you guys have a little bit of that where you wanted to follow in this footstep? Because your mom too, I mean, even though she's clearly a creative, I mean.
Oh, huge. And she you know, she founded the Muppets with our dad. It was just, there was so many kids at home. But definitely we all spent a lot of time on the set with our dad, largely because he worked so much. That, for instance, if he was working in New York on a weekend, he would take at least one of us to work with him. So if it was not a school day and he had to go to work, he would take at least one, maybe two of us to work. So we all spent a lot of time hanging out in the Muppet Workshop, hanging out in the shooting stages, reading. You know, for me, a lot of my childhood was spent reading paperback novels, sitting on the floor of a shooting stage. And loving it.
Me too. Not only on the floor, but under the puppet stage.
Yeah, like literally, yeah.
Yeah, the way that the puppeteers work, they have a raised stage. And then, so the set is raised. So there's this whole kind of underground below the set of scaffolding and such. And there's also monitors down there so the puppeteers can see what they're doing. So as a child, you could plop yourself, hide under this stage, watch what they're doing on the monitors and just go about your business of reading, homework, whatever. Mm-hmm. And we did long days on the set. Like, you know, it wasn't like, oh, visit for an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, you know, call to wrap, and you just got very like used us. To being yeah. there.
Yeah, we just were hung similar. Out for 12 hours yeah. under the set.
This we would thing. Just sit there all day. It was just what we did.
Was it nice to get picked? Meaning like dad's like, all right, you guys come with me, and the rest are like, God damn it. I, you know.
Yeah, actually. But I think he was always very careful to try to kind of give equal time. I think he was always very careful.
I think like those days that we spent with him while he was working and get to be the one kid or the one of the two kids that were there with him that day would feel really, really special, because he was incredibly inclusive. Like, he would bring us into the editing room, to every meeting, to the story meeting, to the private conversation with the executive producer about what's really going on. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we really went with him absolutely everywhere. And then consequently, as you were asking, we did all get very interested in the business. And all of us did work in the business in different ways since we were teenagers, or, you know, unofficially even earlier. And he had this idea that we would have a family company. So he was sort of looking at all of us to see what roles we could take within the company. And, you know, some of us embraced it. Some of us were a little rebellious about those roles. Ultimately, here we are. Like, we own the company together. We run it together. So it all did, you know, his wish came true.
Is everyone involved in it? Not just you
guys?
Yes,
it's to some degree. Everybody is, to some degree. I mean, Lisa and I really put in the most time, I guess, into it. But everyone's involved to some degree. But, you know, when Lisa was talking about how he would bring us anywhere, so there was, I can really only remember one time that my dad was genuinely really, really angry at me. Because he almost never actually got angry. So rarely. And there was one time he was really, really angry because, as Lisa says, he would bring us anywhere. And one day I was in New York with him working, and they had to go do a meeting. He was with Frank Oz. They had to go do a meeting. I think it was Frank Oz. Might have been David Laser. And I was just in the habit of wherever I go, I would plunk myself in the corner and read a paperback novel. So he's going to have a meeting. I don't even really know who it's with or anything. And Jackie Onassis walks in, and we're just sitting. Anyway, we're sitting in this office waiting for my dad to have a meeting. And I take out my paperback novel and just start reading. And Jackie Onassis walks in, it's her office, to have a meeting with my dad. And my dad, and I think it was Frank, stood up and shook hands. And I, of course, just did what I always do, which is I stayed in the corner reading my paperback novel. When we got out of that meeting, he was so angry at me. He was like, you stand up when a woman enters the room. And I was like, I'm sorry, Dad. I don't. You stand up.
Oh, my gosh.
He was really genuinely upset with me that I was that rude, awful, unruly, undisciplined, filthy
especially
kid in the
Jackie
corner
O.
that wouldn't even stop reading his paperback novel.
I'm sure for everyone that, like, Jackie O walking into a room is like,
yeah, but he
stops everybody in their tracks.
But he didn't know.
Except I was so young.
Yeah,
he's like, whoever.
Yeah. So it sounds like he was pretty even tempered. He didn't really get angry much, huh?
He was famously even tempered and almost kind of like zen, peaceful through all kinds of conflict. He actually hated conflict, which is a step beyond being even tempered. Mm. So he's even tempered, but also really did not like conflict around him, and that would give him a little inner conflict at this time. So he could get a little repressed about anger because he just didn't want conflict around him. But he was just a really genuinely upbeat guy who was looked very much the glass half full, very much like, what is, if something is a challenge or difficult, like what can we learn from this? Like, you know, so many of those values of just being genuinely positive, looking for opportunities to be creative and grow and learn from things. Like, that was really what he was like.
That's so amazing. And also like such a hard thing to live up to.
Well, I was just about to ask who's the most like him of the siblings, do you think, as far as disposition goes?
Perhaps our brother who passed away, probably.
Oh, really?
He's very sunny. sunny individual.
Yeah. Yeah.
And mom, did mom appreciate conflict sometimes, or was she also similar, even tempered?
Total opposite.
Yeah,
total opposite. Loved conflict, loved to like just get into it. And consequently, they didn't remain married for their whole lives. Like it didn't work out long term because, you know, he really didn't want to engage in active
conflict,
conflict or debate or, you know, deep questioning. He actually was a very in the moment kind of person and truly very, I keep saying upbeat and positive. There must be a better word for that, but, you know, or a deeper word for that.
But when we were saying our mom, I can remember her getting mad in ways that I used to love. I remember there was one time, oh my God, she threw her, we were at ice cream store and some guy nearly backed up into my brother and I, cause he hadn't looked in his rearview mirror and he started backing out of a parking space and almost hit us. And she just went over and threw the ice cream cone into this guy's car. And then we had to leave quickly. But the truth is it wasn't like she got angry a lot. It was a little tough for my dad cause they co-founded the company. So they created the Muppets together. And then my mom was suddenly so full-time mom because she was pregnant for 5 years straight. And so he'd come home from work all exhausted. And all he wanted to know was, how are we? How's school? And she wanted to talk to him about work. She wanted to know how work was going, how the Muppets were doing. And he didn't want to have that conversation because he was tired and he'd been finishing. So that was sort of, when Lisa says there was a little conflict between them, that was usually at the heart of what the conflict was.
Do you think there was resentment? You know, just like, God damn it, I love our kids, and I know this is where I'm at.
Right, but I'm raising them.
But I'm raising them, and this is something we did together, and I should be there too.
It was both of our dreams.
Right.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, if that makes sense. It makes sense. I mean, at the end of the day, it also was a very different generation, and it might have been different if, you know, it was today.
I can totally relate to both of their situations, my mom and my dad. Yeah.
And she found a great role for herself sort of in the puppetry community, because mm-hmm. while it wasn't easy for her to dip in and out of the day-to-day of running a big business, you just can't do that. Like, you're either in it or you're not in it. Mm-hmm. And for her, it was better for her to not be in it. But she was so good to the puppetry community.
Yeah.
You know, so good at discovering new talent, at helping people in other, you know, other puppet troupes and other parts of the puppetry world, like the theater puppeteers and international puppeteers. And she became like very beloved as a mentor and a teacher and all of that.
She taught puppetry. So most of our puppeteers were initially of that generation were initially found by our
How mom. Old were you guys when they split up?
It was 18. Like early 80s. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So they 18. Were together a long
so you were,
time.
Yeah, you were a little older.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it hard on the family because you were older, or did that make it a little easier?
It was really good because they were in different places. you know, I think for me, like, it was one of those divorces that I was eager to see happen.
And I found they got along better when they weren't living together as
yeah.
well.
I mean, we're all products of divorce. that's what it is.
Article inspired by bold graphic elements of 80s postmodernism. Article's newest look features pops of pastels, jewel tones, playful touches for a no-rules approach that's refreshing, bright, Boom. And inviting. Can I tell you
no
something?
No rules.
Listen, we didn't write that, but I want that.
Yeah, well, the no-rules like, approach I like.
Yeah, I mean, this sentence is from Article's team, I just want them to know I love it. and I'm in. I'm in for whatever that no rules, refreshing, bright, and inviting home feels like.
Well, the no rules is they give you all kinds of options, different styles and colors and palettes and textures, and then you can create your own thing. You can breathe your own life and warmth into your space. You know what I mean? You gotta keep your eyes peeled, your Instagram open for inspiration, because Article has all that stuff. So I was gonna curse. I don't know if I can curse with Article.
Article's newest, they have a new collection, Ollie, and it is all about encouraging mixing and matching styles.
I have a bunch in my house. I have my outdoor furniture is Article. It's awesome. I mean, it really is, and it's good quality. And it's not that expensive because they cut out the middlemen. So when you're buying furniture from like a place, there's so much in between that you're paying for, right? This, you're cutting over, you're saving up to 30% off basically over traditional retail prices.
Right, because
they're selling directly to you. There's no showrooms, there's no salespeople, there's no markups.
Right.
And so you're getting the good quality at great cost. And the shipping is great too, by the way.
Well, it's free over $1,000. Well,
$999.
It's free. And then all in-stock items are delivered in 2 weeks or less, which I love. And it's a 30-day return policy, which is great because honestly, sometimes you get something and you're like, this doesn't work.
Article is offering our listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. So go to article.com/sibling and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/sibling to get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. So this last year has showed us that you never know what life is going to throw at you, you know? And if you use credit cards to pay for unexpected expenses, which we all do, it can be overwhelming to manage the debt. You take control with Upstart so you know exactly what you're going to expect.
Yeah, this is something that I feel like if you are someone that is trying to get a personal loan to pay off and to pay off your debt, okay, then this, you need to hear this out, because Upstart gives you a fast and easy way to do this, and it's all online, whether it's your credit cards, consolidating high interest debt, funding personal expenses. Over 500,000 people, they use it to get a simple fixed monthly payment. Upstart finds smarter rates with trusted partners because they assess more than just your credit score.
So it's a 5-minute online rate check that you can see your rate up front for loans from $1,000 to $50,000. And you can get approved the same day and you can receive funds as fast as one business day. So if debt is just crushing you, it's time to get a fresh start with Upstart. Ooh, I like that. A fresh start with Upstart. Boom.
You get that loan, you pay off your debt, and now you're going to be paying a monthly, which is, I think, really, really, truly life-saving for a lot of people.
Upstart is the fast and easy way to get a personal loan to pay off your debt. And by the way, it is all online. So find out how Upstart can lower your monthly payments today when you go to upstart.com/sibling. That's upstart.com/sibling. Don't forget to use our URL to let them know that we sent you. Loan amounts will be determined based on your credit, income, and certain other information provided in your loan application. Go to upstart.com/sibling.
As a woman, do you think growing up, seeing your mom, you know, she founded this and didn't necessarily was able to follow it through, did that kind of inform the things that you wanted to do as a woman and how you see your work relationship?
Yeah, I was so different from my mom that and sometimes I would question, like, am I even a woman? Like, I was following my dad, like, every step of the way. Like, what can I do to be more like him in every way? So, you know, he was my role model. He was my mentor icon in every way. It took me a really long time to relate to my mom until I had kids of my own. I didn't understand almost anything that she did or why. And then I had a tremendous understanding. You know, as soon as I had kids, I was like, oh, this is huge. Like, mm-hmm. this is really, really amazing. You can make the meaning of your life about kids. But I, you know, I had kids a little bit later and I had a big career, and I just, yeah, I was more defined by not being like her as I was growing up.
Isn't that interesting? And were you, so when you had kids, were you able to sort of balance that career and kids? And were you, was that informed by the way you grew up?
Well, I think I balanced it.
Oliver,
what would they say?
He's an armchair psychologist. You don't have to answer any of his
questions. I think I balanced it, yes, but I've been working full time the whole time I've been raising my kids. And so, you know, there would occasionally be questions like, well, why do you work so hard? Why do you work full time? Mm-hmm. Why don't you just work half time since you're a mom? Mm-hmm. I was like, well, as I said before, it's like, I think you're either in it or you're out of it. Like, you know, to me, I'm in it. And I like to think that the pleasure that I get from the work and the quality of what we do and all of those things, I hope would be encouraging to my kids about having careers of their own or being creatively connected to what they do. And, you know, I'd like to think that I'm being a role model, but, you know, I didn't spend as much time with my kids as my nanny did. Mm-hmm. So
I know.
We were clearly, our dad is, he was the one who was setting the role model of being a functioning adult. And I don't know. I think in our family, I think what we do, what our work is a little bit too important. It's in our heads. Mm-hmm. And I think we're all just a little bit too much trying to define ourselves by what we do. And that creates, I think, natural like insecurities and stuff like that. I think that what I do has been too important to me deep inside. And it makes you a little bit crazy. Makes you a little bit crazy. That's, and I think all of us siblings are a little bit crazy in our family. Yeah. And I think a little bit of that came from it being too important. What you do is just too important.
But you recognize, you know that, but you still just like, oh, like,
and I'm still crazy.
You're still crazy.
Yeah, you do have to remind yourself, like, it's just television.
Yeah.
It's just puppetry, you know?
Yeah, but that's like telling the monarchy, like, you're just a prince. Like, it's legacy stuff. You know, you see and you grow up with your parents not only working so hard, but caring so much about what they're putting out into the world. Like, you do feel a little bit of this sort of duty to that legacy to not let them down.
Is there pressure there?
I mean,
at all?
I know I feel that way.
Yeah, no, there's no pressure.
That what?
He was. They were no, joking.
Oliver was saying, pressure. "Was there pressure?" And yeah. I was like, "Oh my god, are you kidding me?"
Yeah.
I was 27 when I had to take over the company after my dad. I was 26 when he died. 27 when a CEO. The pressure was so horrible.
Yeah.
It was so terrible. Horrible is wrong. Right. Terrifying.
Terrifying
is what it was. But when I made Muppet Christmas Carol, I was 28, I think. And I was terrified throughout all of it. And the pressure to not screw up was so horrible. But it also made me really close with everyone I was working with. Everybody was so supportive. So it was also very rewarding at the end. But yeah, for me, certainly for me, Lisa started her career. She was more in the studio system at Warner Brothers and Columbia, whereas I was freelance when my dad died. I was like, yeah, I was freelance, but at least half the work I was doing was with my dad. And I was a puppeteer and special effects and a director of TV stuff. But the pressure was really intense. I was so terrified of screwing it up.
And I would say, I mean, your father, he was 53, right, when he passed away, 53. I mean, that's so young. I mean, you guys were young. I would think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the not only that pressure, but just having to mourn.
It was very difficult. And I reach out sometimes to other people who lose a famous family member to remember to mourn for yourself. You know, because you have to somehow like address so many total strangers and media and all this, and you forget that you have like yourself to take care of during all of that, you know. But, and yeah, 53 was really, really young. Obviously, nobody was expecting it, and the company was turned upside down instantly. And it was very hard. I personally didn't feel any grief for a year. And then about a year later, I had a huge panic attacks and anxiety, and it all like landed on me. But for a year, I was like a robot, like just a robot dealing with this.
No, it's interesting. It was really, I think my dad was alive in my dreams, still is two nights a week. But for probably 15 years, it was seven nights a week. He was there in my dreams. And yeah, because we didn't really get to grieve. We just sort of
had to take over, right? I mean,
it had to take over, but also the whole world, it's like everybody else took it. In one way, the illusion was that it was comforting when the whole world is mourning for what you feel is your loss, but they feel it all is their loss. The whole world was mourning when Jim Henson died. And so at first you feel like this is comforting because everyone's in this with me. And then you realize you kind of got lost in the mix and you never got a chance to process it yourself or something. Mm. Now I'm not being clear.
Lisa. No, you are. I totally understand. Yeah. I feel like it's like anything else. It just outshines even your own mourning process. You're like, it's so big for everybody else. And therefore, like, I have to be there to kind of stay sturdy.
I think that's right.
How did you feel once you made that first piece and you had to take over and that pressure, was it alleviated once you realized, like, wait a minute, I can do this? You know, was there that moment?
I still don't know that I can do this.
You still don't know?
I don't know. Well, Lisa runs the company now.
Yeah.
I don't know. You always have listen to me. I'm not an arrogant person. I come across as very arrogant, but the truth is I have tons of self-doubt. and so I'm always worried that what I'm doing isn't as good as people are saying. They're saying it's good to be nice to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, when I made that movie Happy Time Murders and the whole country hated it, I was like, finally, somebody's telling me the truth. Right. It's like, finally.
That's so funny.
How do you guys work together? You guys have a good working relationship?
Well, we do we do very different things. You know, I came up through in the business through being an executive and a producer, and he came up through being a performer and a director. And so we definitely meet in the middle in terms of running the company. And Brian ran the company for many years. And then he decided he would focus more on the directing and the show running. And then I've been the CEO for a while, but I think I protected myself from some of these fears that Brian has had by just never putting myself out there creatively on the same level. Mm. Like, because I don't direct and because I don't write and I don't perform, you know, being a producer, you're back, like you're behind the camera, you're behind the scenes, and you get to be a little bit more emotionally protected from the scariness of doing your own creative
yes,
work.
Yes, but darling, you are still a puppeteer, don't you know? You're still holding the strings.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. No, it's interesting. But speaking of puppetry and puppeteering, it is interesting because my father, when he was in his 40s and 50s, he started to kind of realize that he was one of the only really successful puppeteers, and that, you know, puppeteers in general are just struggling, and it was such a, you know, not respected art form. So he started helping other puppeteers through a foundation that he set up and through making, you know, bringing people over from overseas to perform in America. And so it's interesting, both of the sisters who are not on this podcast, both of them are really, really active with philanthropy and helping other puppeteers through the Jim Henson he has a Jim Henson Foundation, and then also the museums that put out Jim's work, which is in Atlanta at the Center for Puppetry Arts, and also in New York at the Museum of the Moving Image. And so, you know, both Cheryl and Heather are really good to the puppeteers.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important because, you know, Jim was taking that responsibility on himself, you know, when he was getting older.
How big is that art form? I mean, would you consider it, like a lot of people consider jazz a dying art form, which makes me incredibly sad. I hope it's not the case. And I hope it, you know, I think the arts always ebbs and flows. But would you say that puppeteering still like maintains, or is it kind of few and far between that people go down that path?
It's been small our whole lives. It's a pretty small community, and it's not much bigger than it was. I will say that the work that like my sisters have done and Jim have, they've done a lot to help the art puppetry world. So, you know, artistic puppeteers who want to do theater, there are a lot more opportunities for them, a lot more theaters interested in it than there was in the 70s and 80s. It's still a pretty small world, very, very intimate. People really know each other.
And most puppeteers are very introverted until they put a puppet on. So, you know, they get to really exercise their alter egos and stuff like that through the puppets. Puppeteers are weird people. They are really weird people. I think Lisa's right. It's been a small community. It continues to be a small community, but they're really crazy people. I do remember going to all these Puppeteers of America conventions and stuff like that and going, wow, they're kind of really crazy people, but crazy not in an angry, mean way, but crazy in a really weird, they're just really weird people.
This is going to be so appreciated by the pub. Look what we're doing for puppeteers today.
No, hey, weird is good.
Weird is good. We need more weird.
Weird is a good thing.
I think the thing is that we're losing sight of all the weirdness because everything has to be so perfect now. It's like the arts are weird. We're weird people, and it should be embraced.
How are some of these characters created? Is it the puppeteer themselves, or do you guys create some of these characters?
They come out of basically three places, the puppet characters. So it's either the writer has created a character on the page and has described the character, and it's come from the script, and then we'll do designs, we'll pair up the character with the right performer, and then it becomes a character. Mm-hmm. But it can also come out of the designers, and sometimes a designer, we call, there are some puppets that are fabricated with no plan, and like with the Muppet Show or the Muppet movies, when they start making the background characters, often the puppet builders are building puppets on their desk where they don't really have a complete plan of exactly how that puppet's going to come out. And that creates some really cool puppets. And then that puppet builder will show that puppet to puppeteers, and then somebody will go, I've got a voice for that character, and it'll come up that way. And it can come from puppeteers. And literally, like, if I pull, like, my favorite characters, they're pretty much a third, a third, a third. It might have come up from the writers, it might come up from the puppet builders, and then some of them are out of the puppeteers. Like, Bill Beretta does Pepe the Prawn in The Muppets Nowadays, and I've known Bill since he was a little kid. And Pepe the Prawn, that crazy character, is his wife's mother, I think, or his wife's aunt. Mm-hmm. And he would do an impersonation of his wife's aunt. And then it was like, we've got to make a puppet of that. and so sometimes it comes out of the performers, sometimes out of the writers, and sometimes out of the designers, which is kind of cool, comes different ways.
How was Kermit and Miss Piggy, like, what was the conception?
Well, Kermit is so old. Kermit is one of the very, very first. So, Lisa, you want to jump on Kermit? Kermit and Piggy are very different.
Well, Kermit was famously sewn from a green felt coat of my father's mother, my grandmother, and a spring coat. Imagine that color is a little bit strange for a coat, but that's the truth. And you know, my mom told
us.
Kermit
wasn't a frog.
He was just a thing.
He was just Kermit. Yeah. He was Kermit the creature.
Oh, look, here comes Kermit.
He didn't have the collar at that point.
We still have Kermit.
And he had human feet, not flippers, but in the first Kermit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but he sewed him when he was kind of, he made him himself, and he made him when he was really young, like still probably a teenager.
Yeah.
And my mom said that my father's grandfather was dying, and that he was like sitting by his side, you know, for multiple days, And that was when he happened to make Kermit. And I was like, wow, that's so interesting. It's very deep. But in any case, he was always considered a bit of an alter ego for my dad because he was in almost every production that did involve Muppets, you know, unless it was a Dark Crystal type of thing. Almost all the other productions had Kermit in some manner, and he became the face of the show. And he was very close to my father's personality, but a little different. Mm. He's a little different, but it's close. They're like alter egos.
And it was interesting because it was Kermit that was like that hosty lead character. Then for a little while, it was Ralph the dog. When our dad was doing Ralph on the Jimmy Dean show, the variety show. And Ralph was on the G. So for a little while, Ralph was our dad's main character. He was the lead Muppet for a while, Ralph. And then after the Jimmy Dean show, it went back to Kermit, and Kermit became the Kermit that we know. But those two characters are clearly the ones that were the most important to our dad, was Ralph the dog and Kermit the frog.
When I think of Oliver, right, and this is like one of those things that when he was little, he loved the Rainbow Connection. That's Oliver's number one.
The Willie Nelson version too is so good.
Yeah. So Oliver, I always think of, whenever I think of like...
I love that song. Still like makes me cry.
Yeah, it makes Oliver emotional.
What about the voice? Was it boom right there? Kermit's voice?
Kermit's older than us. So now we're talking.
Yeah.
But basically he just put a gooey thing into his voice.
That's it.
So Kermit is basically Jim Henson, but he then puts everything into a gooey machine. So he sort of gooeys up his voice and then it becomes Kermit. And it pitched up a little bit from where our dad's voice was. But other than that, there's not a lot. The gooey thing.
Yeah.
That was what he did.
I want to touch a little bit on school. And Lisa, you went to Harvard. And then you were also the first female president of the Harvard Lampoon. And I do want to know a little bit about that because I think that's really cool. How did that happen?
It was really fun. I mean, the Lampoon is a comedy magazine that the school that is published by this club, which is the Harvard Lampoon. And when I went to Harvard, I didn't feel like I fit in that much. Actually, we went to public school in Armonk, and I was aware that I had much less of a good education than a lot of the kids that I met at Harvard. It was like there were so many private school kids. They had studied Latin and Greek, and I was just overwhelmed on a certain level. But the people that I immediately just hooked into, and I felt such common ground with them, were the kids that were on the Lampoon. And then I realized after I joined this Lampoon that I had known other Lampoon members in my childhood that were friends with my father. So Michael Frith, who is the designer of many, many of the Muppets, he had been on the Lampoon. Christopher Cerf, who was Bennett Cerf's son, and Fred Gwynne, who was Herman Munster, who was a friend of, who was like kind of a neighbor of ours, and a friend of my father's. So I had known these Lampoon people. So I suddenly felt like I'd like kind of found my tribe. And it's funny, you were saying before, Kate, that, you know, we're like circus people, you know, like creative people are weird or they're scruffy and they're not perfect. And so when I found the Lampoon, it was kind of like those were my circus people. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Harvard was a little too perfect and the Lampoon was a little more imperfect and felt more right for me. And so I was an artist and did a couple of covers and graphic stuff for them. I wasn't a writer. The real superstars of the Lampoon are always the comedy writers. Mm. And they're still huge in Hollywood.
Huge. Like, yeah.
Huge. Like there's some years where the comedy Emmy is just like 4 out of 5 of the nominees will be Lampoon people.
Yeah.
So it's still really big, but I was a little bit of a misfit even amongst the Lampoon people by being an artist and not a writer. So.
Right. And then you became president. And did it register to you that you were the first female to?
Not at all. It was one of my worst surprises was to wake up the next day and realize that it was news. I was completely unprepared. I did horrible interviews for the Today Show and Newsweek and all these things. And so one thing that I learned from that, and I've kind of taken it with me as an adult, is if somebody ever tells you you need media training to do something, you must do the media training. don't do a bunch of interviews not prepared.
I try to tell that to Oliver, but he still just wings it.
Oh, God, that's why I'm so good at them.
But when you're a first, I would think that there would be a little bit of like...
pride.
Yeah, like, wow, that's, I mean, eventually, maybe now looking
back
on it.
It didn't seem to me that that would matter at all for, you know, in terms of bigger news, because there actually had been women on the Lampoon for 10 years. And there just hadn't been a president of the Lampoon who was a woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, it continues I continue to be surprised when things make news like that.
But Lisa, you know, you're CEO, you're sort of in the business side of things, but you're an artist. You know, what are your creative outlets? Where is your artistry? Do you just put that into your business pretty much?
But just put it into putting people together and putting ideas with talent, with people. And I don't draw anymore. Mm-hmm. I did really enjoy I was very, very artistic as a little kid. Like when Brian was talking about those art project days, I was a huge project maker. And, you know, I wasn't afraid to draw or try to make anything. But, you know, my interest now is making things on a bigger scale. And, you know, the productions are creative. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of embarrassing. It's like, yeah, I give really good creative notes.
I'm really great with structure. Having a father like Jim and then taking over the company for so many years, is there ever a struggle of maintaining what he would have wanted and where you want to grow? Does that ever become yes. conflicting?
Yeah. No. It's really hard. And initially, and then Lisa picked it up after I did it for a bunch of years. But it's tough because you're always trying to protect the legacy and let the legacy grow. But then, like, our dad's number one creative advice is don't ever copy yourself. You know, don't ever, if it's not original, if it's not new, don't do it. Don't invest your time, your energy. Just don't do it because it's just not good enough. I mean, he's the guy who canceled the Muppet Show at the end of season 5 when it was like the most successful show the world had ever seen. He was like, I'm done. I've done 5 seasons. I'm going to start repeating myself now. Mm. So it was tough because people would always say, so do you always try to think what would Jim have done in this moment? And then he said, yeah, well, what he would have said was be original. So that's hard. So it's kind of, so it was always a little bit hard, but definitely for me, and I'm sure Lisa's feeling the same way, trying to guide the creative effort of the company to always be in sync with that, the big mission of Jim Henson. And then always trying to be original at the same time. And then I've had little tangents, like my Happy Time Murders movie that the world hated. That my dad wouldn't have made that. And I have a show called Puppet Up Uncensored, which is a blue puppet show that is a live show. That's actually, that one's very successful and popular, which is fun. So
where is that show? Where is that?
I just put it up. Well, it's a live
show. It's nowhere now.
So it's nowhere now. Nobody's
right.
There's no theater right now.
Oh, it's in a theater. It's a theater show.
I just do it every. I would, let's say last year, yeah. Meaning 19. I had it up at Not Scary Farm.
Oh, cool.
For a while, but I would tour it and then I put it up in the studio. It's just a fun. It was an improv puppet show.
Yeah,
just really fun show.
It's really fun. Actually, we staged it a lot at our lot on the on La Brea. So mm-hmm. people could come and watch the show, but also get a look at our studio, which is pretty private. Yeah. So that was the most fun, I think, when you were putting up that show on the lot. I hope we can do it again.
That's where I was, right?
One day.
Was it Charlie Chaplin's office? Was that? Mm-hmm. That's where I was, right? That was cool.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, what is currently the Henson lot was originally the Charlie Chaplin lot. It's the little Tudor-looking buildings along La Brea near Sunset. And it also had some very cool people own it in between, including a really long ownership by A&M Records. So Herb Alpert had it for years. They have a, we have a beautiful recording studio that's historical that they built. But it's, there's layers of history. There, it's kind of fun that there's layers of history there, though, where you have the Chaplin history.
Yeah.
It was owned by a few other people, including Red Skelton, who, speaking of variety shows, like, he owned it at one point. And then many years owned by A&M Records, so it has all this rock and roll history. And now on top of that, the puppetry and the motion capture and all the kind of animation and things that we do there. So it's really, it's a less than a square block, but, you know, got a lot of history packed into it.
What you're doing is historical. Do you ever feel that way?
No. I think sometimes the spirit, the whole principle of puppetry is bringing something inanimate to life.
Life.
Sometimes they have even the Magic Castle sometimes brings in puppeteers, because there's something like when they bring the beautiful marionettist there, because even though he's not doing magic, he's doing marionetting, but there is something where you do feel like, oh, it's magic. It actually looked completely alive. Mm. And so I think there is a little bit of that in the nature of puppetry. And then of course, like, we've grown up with it and we understand how it's all done. So, you know, we can never say, oh my gosh, I thought it was alive. Like, we're going to always be the insiders to it. But even so, there are times when you sort of like, sit back and go, you know, that is really a startlingly good effect, or mm-hmm. that is really a startlingly convincing moment. Like what you were saying about Ned talks and the character of Ned on the, mm-hmm. on the show, like, that's six people making one performance. And by the way, doesn't Ned's voice sound exactly like Brian?
Yes.
And yeah, I think it's him.
Yeah.
So it's six people impersonating Brian, and it's like, and he's a giant alien.
Yeah.
You know, but when it's so seamless like that, there is a little bit of magic.
Oh, I was in awe. I was in awe there. It was amazing because those little dudes, I forget what you called them, popping up and down.
The claws,
yeah.
Claws.
Yeah.
And it was all of these so crazy talent. Oh, totally psychedelic. These talented people just creating this whole world. And I'm sitting there improvising with I don't even know what, some voice over here. And I remember leaving thinking that was one of my favorite times doing anything as a performer.
Well, you were particularly fun to work with. I've actually been calling you out. I've been doing publicity and all for the show. I often call out your interview because I think we had the most fun doing that.
It was fun.
I am like, really, I did have fun. A moment of like, okay, East Coast, I'm looking at Kermit, your dad, like I'm thinking like Timothy Leary, like, did your dad just drop a ton of acid? Did he do psychedelics at all?
No mushrooms.
No, and
he
both.
And he liked to drink, the way he drank wine was embarrassing. Like, I learned how to drink wine from him, and he would drink like in a big wine glass, like a third of a glass of white wine, and then it was a spritzer, like the rest was
water. You know? It was all water. Yeah. No. And they were like, everybody thought of my mom and dad as they were like hippies. They were like, you guys are the hippies, and they would dress like hippies and everything, but it was everything except for the drugs. They were very clean cut. And also, it's like, He didn't need anything to help liberate his volcano of imaginary thoughts.
I love that.
Did your mom have a puppet? Like, was she voiced? I mean, was like your dad was sort of Kermit, you know, was mom Miss Piggy?
Well, she, like we were saying, she was very involved before we were born.
Yeah.
So, but in those days, most of what they did was lip syncing to existing tracks, like Louis Prima. They loved to like do puppets lip syncing to Louis Prima and other things. Wasn't a lot of voice performance, but yeah, our mom was a really good puppeteer, and she trained all the puppeteers. Mm-hmm. So she was a puppeteer, but there weren't famous puppets that she performed.
Right.
She was very early.
Or no puppet that sort of was her personality, you know, or no, nothing like that.
So with five kids, how many cousins? And how many kids do you all have that are all cousins? Yeah.
Eight.
There's eight.
We had two kids each, except for one of my sisters is single. Mm-hmm. So there's four siblings have two kids each.
I think it's fair to say, and we all had our kids a little bit older. I think it's interesting. We all came out of a big family and none of us went, oh, all I want is to have my own big family.
Mm-hmm. You're like, yeah, you're like, it was enough.
It's like, one, maybe two kids.
Do you guys get to see each other? I mean, forget COVID for a second, but are you guys pretty tight? Do you get together on holidays and, you know, or?
Often.
Yeah.
Yeah, often.
Yeah.
Particularly Thanksgiving, but not this last Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Is it usually LA, New York, or does everybody go to Colorado?
It's really interesting. We've been having Thanksgiving in Florida because my father bought a little cottage in Florida in the days that the Muppets were going into Disney World. And he was planning to spend a ton of time there in Florida. So he bought a little cottage and we go there at Thanksgiving. So that's been our routine.
No, so we kept the cottage and nobody lives down there. So we all would go, most Thanksgivings. And then the cool thing is because we all own the company together, we also have our business meetings like four times a year where we have to spend it. And that's, so it's weird. It's kind of holds us together as well. We all get to see each other a lot, but this last year it's been all Zoom. It's all Zoom. Yeah.
Do you guys agree or are there a lot of disagreements?
Actually, really in terms of the company, we agree a lot. We agree a lot. And we went through one period of time. It was like in the early 2000s where we did in quick succession a bunch of business deals that were very complicated. So it was about 10 years after my dad died. We sold the company. We bought it back. We sold the Muppets to Disney. We launched something else. And in that period of time, we realized like these are not the transactions that people do very well in family companies if they don't get along. Mm-hmm. And everything went really, really smoothly. Nice. So, you know, even though we have sibling conversations, like there are times when we are just a family and we might disagree about family things, when it comes to business, we're like very in sync and very easy to do business with, actually, you know, because we're not, you know, like people don't have to kind of psych out, like, what are the family dynamics if you want to work with the Henson Company? Like, you just don't have to think about that.
Right.
Do you have memorabilia like up the wazoo? I mean,
you know, we were also really careful to get it into museums.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the things that have been built over the years, they're so beautiful. Yeah. Like, you know, a lot of those puppets are pieces of artwork and the amount of handwork that went into all of them. So, you know, the puppets from the early years were sought after by museums. Nowadays, the things we make, they're still really artistic, mm-hmm. but it's a little bit harder to figure out where to put them all because they're not all of mm-hmm. historical importance.
What about Kermit, yeah. the first coat, Kermit made out of the coat? Is that
That's
still-
the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, our mom got, like the very earliest Muppets, they're all at the Smithsonian. Okay. That was something that our mom did.
Before we speed round, I got to know about Miss Piggy because she was such a staple in my life.
Oh, she was just so different. It was
story, actually.
She was my first crush. I was like attracted to her for some strange reason. I liked that sort of gruff, you know, like, you know, that's my kind of woman.
Frank used to describe her character as she's a truck driver who thinks she's Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, hilarious.
Great.
She came in with a Muppet Show. So she became part of the starring cast of a new show. So she had no history before The Muppet Show.
But she wasn't even in the original main cast of The Muppet Show. She wasn't like one of the characters who was drawn out and sketched out by the writers. Like when you were talking about where did the characters come from, this one came really from Frank Oz as a performer, imbuing a very supporting character. Like this pig puppet was just in the chorus.
And in the very early, he wasn't the only one who did the character. But when he did it, it was so funny. But there was, the first thing that happened was there were just a bunch of pigs created. And then they put a wig on one of them and And Frank came up with this personality and this character, and that was it. But she came a lot late, obviously a lot later, not until the Muppet Show.
It is funny that she's the classic chorus girl. You know, she's the classic story of the chorus girl who came to the front and took the solo and then became the lead of the show.
Yeah.
Because she was literally a chorus girl pig.
Wow. And that's really funny. Yeah. It's like, what is it called? 20 Feet from Stardom, the documentary. Yeah. It's like her.
She was a backup singer puppet.
And then she went for a big makeover. So if you look at her very first, it was really like a pig puppet with a wig on. But that's really a character that came out of Frank Oz. That really came out of his head.
What do we have to look forward to from your production company in these next couple years?
So many things.
All sorts of stuff. I mean, we try to say everything that we do has an element of fantastical invention in it, but nowadays we do 3D animated shows, we do 2D animated shows in keyframe animation, we do digital puppetry, which is 3D animation, but it's all puppeteered, it's all live performed and live shot. We do all of our puppet productions, and then we do science fiction and fantasy. Mm. And we do a little bit of everything. Do movies, TV shows, some of it's for a more adult audience, some of it's specifically for kids, but honestly, we just try for real, like, creative excellence, being creative. Mm-hmm. It's a celebration of being creative and original is what we try to do whenever we're making something.
A lot of people expect us to kind of revisit the old titles, and we do. You know, we did the big Dark Crystal series for Netflix. We are now doing a new Fraggle Rock series.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yes.
Fraggle Rock. Yay. That was my
There's a lot of love for Fraggle Rock out there.
That was like our...
Was it? Let the music play. Waiting for another day. Down to Fraggle Rock.
It was part of this new thing called HBO. And we remembered our dad really loved the idea of HBO because... I think up until then, the idea that basically what you're doing is you're making TV shows so that there will be people watching television when the commercial break comes. And the reason of existence is to make sure there are eyeballs for when the commercial breaks happen. That's what the business of television was, the 4 minutes of commercials every half hour.
Right.
And so my dad, he really loved the idea of HBO. That was right, that people were actually paying money for a subscription to be entertained.
What would your dad think about today? Technology, all the platforms that are available now, Netflix, streaming. Would he? Do you think he'd love it or hate it? I mean,
he kind of loved everything.
Yeah,
like he loved innovation and new ways of doing things. I mean, he probably would be more abrasive than I probably am, because I'm like, oh, I've got to protect puppetry and stuff like that. He'd be like, oh, let's do something different. I don't know. He would love all of it. And he saw like reality TV coming. Mm-hmm. He knew that cameras were going to become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And that before you knew it, that programming was going to be coming from a 22-year-old kid and their two best friends, in the middle of nowhere would be producing, huge hit television shows. He kind of saw all that coming. And what a shame, because he would have only been 83 today. Yeah. Like he could have still been alive and working. And would have been, how much would he have done, and much more would he have done if he hadn't died?
I feel like he would have gotten incredibly interested in virtual reality as well as anything like immersive and interactive, because he was very interested in stereoscopic, and I was like, why are you interested in that? Like the green and red glasses, but he was really into it, and that led to him doing a 3D movie at Disney. But he was really into it because of its potential for being immersive, and he was very interested in anything like interactive. So, everything has developed way, way, way beyond what he was thinking of at that point.
I think one thing that's such a shame is that, when he made Labyrinth, with David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly, the movie was a terrible flop when it came out. And that was the last big thing that he had finished before he died. And it's such a shame because the film has done substantially better every year than it did the first year it was made. So now it's a huge hit and it's a cult classic and it's the most important title in our library. And I wish he had seen that because unfortunately, when he passed away, that was his big commercial failure was Labyrinth, which is now, nobody believes you. When you say to them, oh, you know, it was a huge box office failure. They go, no, couldn't have been. It couldn't have been. It's a classic.
Yeah, it is. Cult
Your dad, fun. I have this little thing here that I love when he wrote a letter before he passed away. And he said, please watch out for each other and love and forgive everybody. It's a good life. Enjoy it. Mm. Is that like a touchstone for you guys?
Very much so. Yes. I think he was actually doing his estate planning and instead of just leaving a bunch of documents like we all do, he had the thoughtfulness to write a letter and enclose it in the documents, and the letter sat there for years and years. And, you know, it wasn't particularly prescient that he wrote that. I think the letter was sitting there for quite a long time along with his estate planning. But it did make me think, what a nice thing to do, and everybody should do that. Mm, everybody should write something personal to go with those legal documents.
Yeah. You
know? As a person, he was somebody that always had his little lessons. You know, we have like a lot of Episcopal ministers in that side of the family. And our dad was quite like that. I mean, often we'd sit down for breakfast and he'd have basically a little lesson that he wanted to share that day over breakfast, which I can't imagine doing with my kids. not in that sort of formal way, but he always had his little things. And oh my God, he loved the cassette players that you put in your cars before anybody else had them, when they were the 8-tracks and then the cassette players. And he'd always have the best one and it would always get stolen in New York. And he just had to, you could see it was always so disappointed when we'd get back to the car after dinner and the windows were smashed again and the stereo was gone again. And he'd go, well, I guess obviously they needed it more than I did.
Wow.
Than I did.
Yeah.
So
that's a special kind of person there. Yeah.
So great.
That's the opposite of what I would have done.
I love your dad.
I know.
All right, guys, let's do the speed round. Some of these you can also answer your other siblings if you want. One word to describe the other.
I'm just going to say smart.
I would say engineer.
Mm-hmm. One word to describe your relationship.
Supportive.
Cool.
Who's the most artistic?
Oh, Brian. As between us, Brian.
I think I've done more art, but I don't know that I'm more artistic.
If your sibling was a Muppet, which one would they be?
Ned. as I've said.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Lisa, see, she has to be the smart, cool one. Sure. You know, it would have to have been one of Jerry Nelson's characters, like Floyd or something.
Oh,
it's not one of the female characters.
Floyd. I'll take it.
Something that your sibling is really not good at.
Both of us cooking.
Yeah, we're both not good at cooking.
Who's more competitive?
Oh, we're both crazy competitive.
Are you?
Equal.
Yeah, we're both crazy competitive. In fact, that's part of why we approach things and like. Lisa came out of development and executive and I came from the floor, so that we're always a little bit different. So we're never like directly competing with each other.
Right.
That's good. That was very clever. That's a good thing. Who gives the best advice?
Me.
Oh, that's so interesting. No, actually it is Lisa, because I'm terrified of giving people advice. I don't want to give people advice.
If you guys disagree, or when you do disagree, is there a topic that you disagree on the most? You know, is there something that you guys just do not see eye to eye on?
This one just ought to be at the tip of my tongue, and I can't think.
What do we disagree? I don't know. I mean, there is something when it comes to actual like movie making, or, and I, when I say movie making, I mean TV shows or whatever, where I have less respect for the committee than Lisa does, because I grew up on the floor. I have more respect for the vision.
Yeah.
But
that's a good one. That's a good one.
Struggle there.
That's a good one.
First celebrity crush.
Oh, mine was 100% Debbie Harry.
Yeah, that's a good, good one.
100%. Yeah. It was almost Linda Ronstadt, but then it was Debbie Harry. Yeah.
I'm like blanking out. I say, but I have a feeling it has to do with that first season of Saturday Night Live. The Muppets were on Saturday Night Live, and we got to go. From the whole first season, we got to go and watch Saturday Night Live. And that was like when I felt like I grew up from being the high schooler that I was at public high school in Armagh, New York, to like a cool person that goes to New York City and goes to 30 Rock and watches Saturday Night Live and comes home and tells people at school that I was there and saw it live, season one, two, and three. It was just season one.
But you're like,
I was in high school. I was like 11th grade or 10th or 11th grade. So it was probably like Chevy Chase or something.
Yeah.
You're like, it's the 70s.
Chevy was
you're
the man.
A teenager. It's the 70s. You're a teenager and you're at 30 Rock watching SNL.
Pretty cool.
At night.
Season one. Yeah.
I mean, nothing's cooler than that.
That's all time.
And
right
for
there.
Sure, it was Chevy Chase because yeah. Chevy Chase was hot. Yeah.
That's so interesting. I think. But Lisa, weren't you a big fan of Jack Burns when you were like really little? And then he became the head writer on the Muppet Show. So I thought you were a big fan, but now that's really little. Because Burns and Shriver was a show that was really important in our household. And then Jack Burns ended up being the head writer on the Muppet Show.
Oh, wow.
Well, yeah, I had a childhood.
It was like we got to meet this guy that had been so important to us.
All right, seriously, nobody who's listening to your podcast knows who these people are that we're talking about. But I did have a childhood crush on Tommy Smothers.
Okay.
Oh, there you go.
I like comedians.
You know?
It was Chevy Chase. It was Chevy Chase, John Belushi, Gilda Radner.
John King.
Dan Aykroyd.
Dan
Aykroyd.
Dan Aykroyd.
Belushi was and, Belushi the first year? No.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. He was.
Cool. Oh, it's the coolest.
I remember because I remember him going around the halls going, oh, what? Uh-oh, here they come, the mucking puppets.
You didn't actually witness that, did you?
I absolutely witnessed that.
You witnessed it? That's like, I thought that was an apocryphal story.
No,
I saw him walking down the hall and he yelled, there they are, the mucking puppets.
There you go. Some of those apocryphal stories are very lovingly.
No, I heard it in the hall.
I mean, the poor Muppets, you know, they were really, really a big flop on Saturday Night Live.
Oh, so were they? I didn't even know that.
We were really cool that we got to go and see it. The Muppets were like, the only thing that didn't work on Saturday Night Live. So it was this outrageous, huge, huge hit. And everybody was talking about it. And it was the show of, it's been the show of the century practically. And the Muppets got fired off of it after season one.
That's so sad. Let's go in because Kate earlier were saying, but what really happened was Jim was trying very hard to make the Muppet Show. And all of the broadcasters in America said, Muppets are for little children. That's what Sesame Street has proven. The Muppets are just for little kids. And my dad was furious. So he made his first pilot of the Muppet Show was a Valentine's special, the Valentine's with Mia Farrow that was going to be with your mom. But it was with Mia Farrow. And he made that, and it went on air, and that was his pilot. And all three networks passed and said, no, puppets are for little kids. It's Sesame Street. You should be sticking with that. He was furious. So the next pilot, he then sold a second pilot for The Muppet Show, and he called it Sex and Violence with the Muppets so that people wouldn't say it was just for a little kid. And he made that and put it on air. And all three networks passed on doing the series. And then he was so pissed off that everybody was saying, you should just be doing children's shows like Sesame Street, that then he went and did Saturday Night Live because it was they're already controversially going to be the most offensive adult TV show ever made of its time. So he's like, that's where I'm going to be. I'm going to prove that I'm not just for little kids. And then during that season one, Lou Grade in London, who ran ITV or ATV Studios, was it, called and said, I've seen your pilot. Bring your Muppets here to England. I will make a series. We will shoot the whole series and we'll sell it back to America, which is exactly what happened. So you're saying he got fired, but Lisa, as soon as Lou Grade wanted to make a Muppet show, he was counting the days until he could get off of Sesame Street. Get off of Saturday Night Live. Because all he really was trying to do was get the Muppet show made.
He was pitching
the Muppet show for years and years and years and years. It's really interesting because people think he had so much just automatic success, but like how much rejection he had for the Muppet Show was incredible.
The success of Sesame Street was a problem because he was sort of on a track that was pointing to the Muppet Show. And then Sesame Street was so successful that everybody was like, well, make more preschool education shows. And that's not what
I think it's really important for any creative to hear these kinds of stories. Cause I'm always like, success is like you hear more no than you do yes. And yet you just have to keep going to know that the Muppets took so long. It's wild, right?
It was really hard for him.
Okay, I have to ask, what's your personal favorite Muppet?
Ralph the Dog.
He's great.
I usually say I can't answer this.
Go and give it to them. You've never told anybody your favorite Muppet. They want to.
I like them for different reasons, but I guess Gonzo probably was my favorite.
Gonzo
is the greatest.
Does anybody ever say that Kermit is their favorite? I mean, it's like, I feel like because he's like the number one, nobody says he's the favorite.
Most people do say Kermit's their favorite. And I often say Kermit's kind of my favorite because he was the most like my dad. I mean, Kermit was, if you know Camp Kermit well, you knew my dad well.
Okay, so the very last question that we always ask, Ollie, you ask the question.
Two-part question. First part being, if you could alleviate something, if you could take something from your sibling that will alleviate a stressor in their life or something to make their life a little bit better, what would it be? And on the flip side of that, if you could take something for yourself, a quality that they possess that you wish that you had, what would that be?
Huh. Well, Brian was speaking earlier about feeling pressure and stress of living up to the legacy. I'd love to take some of that off of him because I think he's great in his own right. And I would like to take a little of his perfectionism onto me. Because I think as a producer, I need to get things done. And so I'm like, hey, let's just approve 75% of everything we look at, you know, because we just got to get going. So if I could take some of his perfectionism on me so that our work is better, if I could afford to do that, I definitely want to do that.
I don't know what I would take off of Lisa. I don't know. I know of burdens that she has that are too personal to talk about.
Yeah.
But you can like say that. Certain burdens.
That are too personal.
Just the two personal burdens I want to take them away.
That I wish she didn't have to have that are not of her making. Mm-hmm. And then if I could be able to multitask, I feel like I'm incapable of multitasking. For me, multitasking means I do one thing for an hour, then something else for an hour. I can't even like do 2-3 emails at the same time. It's like I have to stay with that email until I'm done with it. Yeah. And then I do the next one. Lisa says, well, I can manage 8 shows. It's like, I don't know what that means. I can delegate 7.
That was excellent.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you
so
much.
It was so fun talking to you.
It was awesome.
Like it was our dinner party.
I know, this
love
was
it.
Great.
It's been really, really fun and lovely talking to you guys.
Sibling Revelry is executive produced by Kate Hudson and Oliver Hudson.
Producer is Allison Bresnik.
Editor is Josh Windisch.
Music by Mark Hudson, a.k.a. Uncle Mark.
If you want to show us some love, rate the show. And leave us a review. This show is powered by Simplecast.
something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, stories from the frontiers of marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. Is getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.